Good morning, everyone, and good evening to everyone listening across the planet today. You're back on Radio Tony Everyday Business with our real estate agent, Amir Michelle. And last week, we were talking about the options and the different options that are available on real estate contracts. And in the intervening time since our last conversation, Amir has managed to renovate two properties in Oberon. Now, I'm going to ask him a little bit about that, but before I do, just a quick reminder that if you've missed the live of this show, don't forget to jump on to Binge TV Networks USA, Tony TV channel on Binge Networks, and also available on YouTube. Now, Amir has had a lifetime observing real estate and partaking in the buying, selling, and renovating of real estate. And from the tender age of about 10, he watched his parents renovate for profit. And since then, at only 16, he started with $5,000 and has turned it into a real estate empire. Welcome back to the show, Amir. I know you've been busily renovating on the weekend. So before we get into today's show, can you quickly just tell the audience what you've been up to? You've been working incredibly hard on both these properties, and in a week, can you quickly tell the audience what you've achieved on those properties? All by yourself,
yeah, sure.
I might add. Good morning.
Well, good morning. A lot of the fun things about having a distant property is that you can book in tradespeople, and you can book in specialists to come out to you. And so you almost make a holiday of going out to the country and meeting people on site. So there's some things that I know that I can physically do that doesn't necessarily require any expertise or a big set of muscles. And so I tend to do a few of the laborer type jobs myself.
Yeah.
One of those things was going through the local council had a pickup that they do either once a year or twice a year. So you can roll out some of the old furnishings and bulky things onto the roadside. And as long as you put it on the curbside on the correct garbage collection day, they'll come and take it free to the tip. So I love recycling, and I like separating different items into different areas. But in this little area, I had a decent sized lockup garage. So I've been, I guess, for the last almost 5 years, every time a cupboard needed to be pulled out or a door needed to be replaced, I'd stack it in a different area. So wood is one part of the garage, and old tires are another part of the garage, etc. And my theory was that once somebody comes in and we get a builder or a carpenter to do a big renovation, they'll bring a skip bin and we'll just put the right things in the skip bin and recycle the rest and take, you know, wood on one day and
yes,
et cetera, et cetera. Anyway, so I happen to be in the right place at the right time, and somebody knocks on my door and, you know, we have a little conversation, et cetera. And as I'm driving out or about to drive out, my car's flat. So I'm about to go for a drive from this place and the battery doesn't start. What I noticed was it's a station wagon, and the light right at the back of the station wagon where the hatch opens
yes,
up was left on.
Uh-oh.
So obviously I stacked it up to the roof, and something has clicked that little switch up top and changed
flattened
the battery. Just sat there for, I mean, I don't do much driving when I'm out in the country. You kind of arrive and then everything is catered for you. You've got your internet, you've got your TV, you've got your laptop. You don't need anything else. Everything else is just, you know, you sit and you do your work on your laptop.
Yeah.
So you don't really drive out as much as you do when you're in the city. So I'm sitting there, and maybe 24 hours later, I go to start the car to go for a drive and the car doesn't start.
Oh, no.
Good thing is, in regional areas, most of your neighbors are friendly. So I go next door and I knock on the door. And, you know, they bring their ute and jumpstart my car, and it's all good. It takes 5 seconds and it's going. And they see some of the stack in my garage, and they say, oh, you know, on Monday they're picking up the garbage. I'm like,
yes.
So I have a little trolley, not a shopping trolley, but I don't like to hurt my back. I prefer to use machines rather than lifting things myself.
Correct.
So I've just, you know, I'll put things on a roller and I roll it up to the curbside and I stack these things up on the lawn. And, of course, 2 days later, council comes, picks up everything and just puts it in the right trucks and all that kind of stuff. They have two trucks driving around, one for recyclables, one for not. I probably cleared about 3 meters by 2 meters by 1 meter, which is, it's full skip bin worth of stuff.
Yeah.
So I managed to just put everything into one or three neat stacks.
Yes.
They came, they collected. And normally, you know, car tires are $15 a tire to pick up. And, you know, like a skip bin hire might be $200, $300.
That's right.
So it was just, first of all, it was good not to have to pay for it. But the more important thing, I don't know how much time it saved me by just
not
moving things that 3 meters from my garage to the curbside.
Definitely.
And having the right kind of tools of just being able to wheel it to the curb. I mean, that's just smart.
Yeah, absolutely. And so we were talking before the show, and you've also done the removal of carpet and painting inside and out. What else did you get up to?
I didn't remove any carpet.
Oh, you didn't this time?
I did do a lot of... No, I didn't. I don't like to touch the carpet myself. It's easier for whoever's laying the new carpet to take it out.
Uh-huh.
Because the minute that you take the old carpet away, you've got no protection on the wooden floors.
Yes.
You also find that... the little the pin things that hold it, that's not the technical term, but the grips that hold the carpet on the edge.
You step on them.
You know, right by your walls. Either you step on them or they start getting damaged or water damaged.
Yeah.
But quite often you don't need to replace them every time you replace carpet. So if you leave it for the carpet layers to do,
they've got the
right type of pivoting crowbars to very quickly take it off without damaging the subfloor or the wooden timber floor underneath.
Yeah.
So I tend to stay away from things that the experts decide what to do, whether to do it or not to do it.
Uh-huh.
But it's the good thing about having old carpet there is you don't worry about spills.
No, so and not, you can paint.
Painting,
and, yeah.
You're not worried about moving your mats every 3 meters. You've got to lift up your ladder, move all the... non-slip, non-drip, and all that. So having old carpets there means you can just do your job. Just go, you'd use your roller, you use your paintbrush for the edges.
Get it all done and then do it.
You actually get more done.
Yeah.
You actually get more done if you're not so precious about the carpets underneath.
Yeah.
And reality is you don't really spill much. It's more the little sprinkles.
Yes.
So you know when you do your roller and there's like a little spray of that little few dots?
Like light rain.
Like little sprinkles, and they're little micro dots.
Yeah.
But you always find them on your watch, don't you?
Yes, on
it's
your
always
watch.
Your wristwatch. There you go. Oh,
yeah.
I just realised that I was painting because now I'm with the black band of my wristwatch has little white speckles on it.
That's right. Yeah,
it's a new trend.
Especially when you're doing the ceilings with a roller. That's the when it always gets me. Not so much the walls, but the ceilings and reaching up to those ceilings and the splatter from that. So yes, I know what that's like. So obviously, you had a very productive 2 weeks, which leads us into just a little bit of a recap. Last week, we talked about options, and before the show, we talked about some of the options you have for these properties. But this week, we wanted to expand on that topic. And in talking about what we're going to talk about this week, Amir wanted to discuss some of the pitfalls around buying real estate. And there's a number of key topics within this conversation itself. So, Amir, what are some of the pitfalls and some of the warning signs to look for when you're looking at real estate to purchase?
It's not so easy to get it wrong, and it's not so easy to get it right, and there's a lot of gray areas in between.
Yeah.
So what I look at is not, I guess, not really pitfalls, but more the, if you know this and you can avoid it, you'll save yourself a lot of headaches.
Yes.
So it's like a hack, a life hack.
Yes.
A cheat code.
It's a real estate hack.
So if you've got the cheat code to this, it's a real estate hack. If you've got a cheat code to this, because it's so general and it happens so often, that you can really move through the real estate world without having to learn from your own mistakes. You can learn from other people's mistakes.
Good.
It means you're saving yourself time and money. One of the biggest things, and there's only really three. First one is the big A.
Yes.
Which is asbestos.
Yes.
The next one is the big T, which is time.
Oh, I was going to say termites.
No, not No, see, there's like little hazards that people know about, which is the building inspection and the pest inspection.
Yeah.
But there's things that if you weren't an expert and this was your first time doing it, you would listen to words and expect them to be the same as common language.
And
So
they're
option
not.
was one of them.
Yeah.
So you'd think that option means that you might or you might not, but it actually has a legal term.
It does.
One of the other things that you'll discover, and hopefully your solicitor's on top of this and will explain to you in normal English, not just in real estate English.
Yeah.
Words like time is of the essence.
Yes.
So that phrase of time is of the essence is like, you know, I just expect you to be on time. It's important to respect my time. It actually means something very specific and not
in
just
real
the common term in real estate, in contracts. So when it comes to buying and selling, if your contract says words or phrases like time is of the essence, ask your solicitor, ask your conveyancer, because they'll explain to you in normal terms what implications that has if you're running late for your meeting. So, for example, if time is of the essence is specifying a date and you can't settle or your bank's not ready and it's only delayed by a day or 2 days, you don't feel that the owner, the person selling it to you, the vendor, would really get upset because at the end of the day, you're still paying.
Yeah.
But the words time is of the essence means that from the agreed date, you're paying interest at the rate that it says on your contract. So your bank might give you 3% interest and the contract that your solicitor negotiated with the other solicitor says that your default interest, meaning that if you're late on any dates,
and
might
that
be 10% or 12% or 8%. And that whatever it says on your contract is what both sides have agreed on. So it has nothing to do with your bank interest rate. That's on top of your bank interest rate.
Mm-hmm.
So you might fall into a trap of having a 12% interest on being late. So if you're 3 months late,
that's
you're
paying a lot
12%
of
interest per annum. But think of 12 months in a year, 12% per annum is 1% per month.
Yep.
So on a $3 million house, 3%, 1%, 1%, 1% of a $3 million house, that's a lot of cheese.
A lot of money,
That's a lot
Amir,
of money.
When
and
we
that
talk,
goes straight to the owner.
Yeah. When we talk about that phrase, time is of the essence, that means that by 5 p.m. or the close of business on that day when that contract is due, after that time, that's when that interest comes into play, correct?
Speak to your solicitor.
So
look,
absolutely.
For example, if the next day is a public holiday or if the next day is a Saturday, there might be rules in your contract that were negotiated. They're usually clauses or it might be on a different page to your normal contract. So on top of the contract, there's other pre-negotiated terms that come after the contract but form part of the contract.
Which,
so depending on whether you've done this as an option, whether it's an auction, a private treaty, whether you're in New South Wales, Tasmania, or Northern Territory, each place has a different ruling.
Yeah.
And in some states and in some territories, you might say on the contract that it's 12%, but if the other side takes it to a judge, the judge says, you know what, the fair level should be 6%. And it doesn't matter what it says in the country, what it says in the contract.
Ah, so, okay.
That's why I always say, if you're dealing with legal terms, speak to the conveyancer of the state or the territory you're purchasing in, where the house is.
Yeah.
So one of the things that I'd love to talk about, Tony, and this is, again, a way of getting caught, is if you have a lot of experience in Victoria, but you don't have much experience in Tasmania, or you have a lot of experience in New South Wales, but you don't have any experience in Western Australia, the rules are slightly different in each place.
And it does make a difference,
in Hobart,
doesn't it?
Big time. In Hobart, I purchased a house as an investment property in Hobart about seven years ago.
Yeah.
And before I purchased, I spoke to legal conveyancers in Hobart.
Mm-hmm.
So the rules in New South Wales are if you make an offer on a property, then the real estate agent you're speaking to will take that offer to the owner, to the vendor. If they agree, they'll send you an email saying, we agree, and then you sign and give money as a deposit. They countersign and give you a receipt saying they've taken your money and they've given you a contract back. That's swapsies.
Yes.
That's called an exchange.
Yes.
In Tasmania, in Hobart, just obviously I found out before I bought, if I send an email to a real estate agent saying I'd like to offer you $400,000, and let's say during that weekend I inspected five properties, the other three I wasn't really interested in, one of them is fantastic and one of them I wouldn't touch with a 10-foot pole, so five inspections. One I absolutely love, so I make an offer of $400,000. The other three, I'm kind of wishy-washy on. I'll offer $300,000, which is well below what they're asking for.
Yes.
And the fifth one I wouldn't touch with a 10-foot pole, so I kind of give a throwaway $200,000 offer, which is well below. If I get an email back from all those five real estate agents, let's say they're five different companies, and they all say yes, then I've just bought the one I love, the three that I'm semi about, and the one that I hate. So now I owe 250 plus 300 plus 300 plus 300 plus 400.
All because of an email.
Because I didn't think all of them would say yes. Because I sent it on an email, they sent it on an email back. So now it's written as a offer and acceptance. So even though I didn't pay anything, I am now obliged to pay the rest of the deposit and finish the rest of the contract terms. Because I've seen the contract.
Oh,
I've been
my
to
goodness.
The inspection. I send them an email. They send me an email. And that was only 7 years ago. So every 6 months, things can change.
Yeah.
So, yeah, they say buyer beware, but that's such a bumper sticker, isn't it? That's like, you know, there's some expressions, some idioms that just come out of the English language that they're funny at the time, but then they're just overused and they become bumper stickers. So one of the things, Tony, I don't know if you've come across this before, is have you heard the saying, how long is a piece of string?
Oh, all the time. All the time.
What does that mean to you?
It means that whatever subject you're talking about or whatever concept you're talking about is has many variables and different opinions. Yes, how long is a piece of string? Is exactly what I'm trying to...
Let's put some dollars against this.
Yeah.
So imagine you're hiring a carpenter. The carpenter comes, looks at the old house that you've just bought.
Yeah.
And your vision, what you're trying to describe, and I say trying because you're verbally doing this for the first time. You're talking to a carpenter who works full-time as a carpenter, and they've done 1,000 jobs, very highly experienced.
Yes.
Out of the 1,000 jobs, they've seen 990 of those jobs do exactly the same thing with their kitchen. Your kitchen drawers have handles that you pull this way. In other words, that little bit of metal is horizontal.
Yes.
Not vertical, but horizontal. So you hire a carpenter and they come to have a look at the old kitchen. And you ask the carpenter, okay, well, look, what I want is I want you to come in. I'll give you the keys for 2 weeks. Come in. Remove the kitchen, remove the current kitchen, get it back to the normal walls, patch up any holes.
Yes.
And I've delivered some flat pack furniture from my local hardware store that's a flat pack kitchen.
Yes.
So I want you to assemble the kitchen, put the drawers, put in the base cabinets, which are the ones at the bottom, the ones that are mounted on the walls as well, so your top cabinets. So you've got wall cabinets, you've got base cabinets, you've got the kitchen sink and a bench top. So what things are obvious? Well, you'd think, okay, well, gravity works the same anywhere on the planet. So obviously you're going to put the heavy things at the bottom and the light stuff on top. So your base cabinets are deeper. Your wall cabinets are shallower. It makes sense that if you had the big cabinets up top and you're trying to reach something underneath, you'd hit your head each and every time.
Correct.
So you don't need to describe to your carpenter that the deep ones are the base cabinets going on the bottom.
Well,
and
I hope not.
The small ones are the wall cabinets. But think of this, Tony. Every set of drawers, at least every set of drawers I've ever seen, come out this way, correct?
Yes.
So your drawer is a rectangle coming out that way.
Yes.
So your carpenter would assume that the handles, if you've got those little rectangular handles, they would come out at the same angle.
Yep.
But there's doors on the left and doors on the right. Not the drawers, but now you're thinking of cabinets next to it.
Yes.
Some people visually think that if you put your handles all
horizontal
this way, it makes your ceilings look taller because it gives you that slimline illusion.
Ah, okay.
Other people think, well, those little horizontal things, because the drawers are like this,
they
you
should be
put
the same.
Your doors like that as well, because then it just gives you a nice streamlined look. And when you're walking into the kitchen, you could see everything's in a straight line, and it gives you a very tidy,
nice
look.
Aesthetic.
Depending on what the owner or the person whose vision it is to put this kitchen together has in their head, needs to be described very specifically. So this is one of the buyer beware things.
Absolutely.
So if you have a carpenter who perhaps has done two or three jobs for you, and the other 990 jobs out of the 1,000 they've done, everybody's requested horizontal. Everybody.
Mm.
Except for you in the last kitchen, you're one of the 1,000 that asked for it to be
vertical
and for the drawers to be horizontal. Why would they remember your job out of the 1,000? Especially if the last job they did for you was 4 years ago.
Mm.
You know, think of this. They're working full-time as a carpenter. So they're doing it day in, day out.
Yes.
The last 150 or 250 jobs between your last job and this job has been different.
Mm.
So they're not going to remember that. So here's one of the clues that would save you time and money, save you frustration, would make the carpenter happy at the end and be happy working for you, and make you happy at the end because you don't need to do rework and pay for somebody to fix it later.
Mm.
Get a scope of works.
Yes.
What do I mean by that? A scope of works is a list of, I expect you to do this, to remove this, and then fix this, and then paint this, or don't paint this.
Mm-hmm.
I want the handles facing this way, not that way. The drawers should all have facing this way, and the doors should be facing the opposite way as vertical.
Yeah.
I want the pantry door to open on the right
that
hinge, so when you're facing it, the hinge is on the right. I want the fridge to be on the left-hand side when you're facing it, etc.
Mm.
Your kitchen sink is probably going to be by the window. Mm. So gravity, you don't need to explain that the big cabinets go down the bottom and the small cabinets up top, but there are so many other items, many other little things you need to know. Even the space at the edge of your kitchen, so that when the door opens, the handle of the door doesn't bang the corner.
Yeah.
So some people prefer a big edge. Once your kitchen's finished, they put a fake piece of timber at the end,
so
like
that
a spacer,
to
separate it so that your door doesn't bang. Or your hand doesn't get jammed up against the wall when you're opening the thing. Other people want it going all the way up and they don't want a door on the edge.
Yeah.
So everybody's got their own preference. But only a few carpenters are mind readers.
Mm. But they should all... they should all do a scope of works though, Amir. In your experience, do most carpenters do a scope of works?
No, most of it... They do a visual and they write down notes. They bring a little carpenter's pencil and on your blank wall, if you've already removed everything, they mark on the wall where things are and they write cabinet, this, this, this. So they write a few measurements while they're there with a tape measure so that when they're on site, they don't need to refer to another piece of paper because the more things you carry, the less you can do your work. So a lot of them just write on the wall before it's painted, obviously. They write on the wall little notes of kitchen, sink, starts here, finishes here, etc. But if the person who's hiring them isn't experienced and hasn't seen both vertical and horizontal, or if they haven't thought of the logistics of having a door open all the way out, they can not think of it. It's just not, just like the word that we were talking about before, Tony.
Yes.
It's not a normal word to say time is of the essence means there's interest paid on that date.
Mm-hmm.
That's not, you can't assume that somebody would know that, but it's very important. And you'd save yourself a lot of frustration and money if you do it the right way.
Yeah.
Another thing, and I know last time we ran out of time, I want to make sure we cover this, and that's the big A, asbestos.
Yes, yes. So, this is a big topic, particularly around real estate.
For people who don't know. Yeah, particularly around property, especially... So if you're buying a brand new house, you're buying a house and land package, then whatever they're building today, anything after the year 2000 is not going to be built from asbestos. It's not going to have...
That's right.
It's not going to contain asbestos products. Mm. If you're building in Australia, there's other rules in Australia like formaldehyde.
Yes.
There used to be glues that would have formaldehyde in them. There's asbestos, which is harmful. Asbestos
Very
is harmful,
harmful
for the lungs. There's 100 different products that had asbestos in it.
Mm.
There's very famous Australian personality that's on Channel 10 in the living room,
yes.
Cherie Barber. Cherie Barber is one of the ambassadors in Australia for asbestos awareness. Mm. So she helps people understand that when you're renovating, before you start,
you have to know about asbestos.
Before you rip up tiles, there might be asbestos glue underneath tiles.
Mm.
There might be that little black product underneath things that you don't know what it is. Sometimes that contains asbestos because asbestos is a natural product. You can find it in caves.
Mm.
But the thing of it is that the fibers are so small that they float up in the air and they can be swallowed or ingested into the lungs. And they lodge there and then things build around them and make mucky stuff.
Horrible things.
Lungs. Yeah. So without going into the medical side of things, asbestos is not good. So they've decided in Australia to not use asbestos. They've also, and you know, I thank the Australian government for this, both from a New South Wales feature, but also nationally. Sometimes the government has put in grants for inspections paid for by the government to come to your old house and check whether you have loose asbestos.
Yes.
What do I mean by loose asbestos? I don't know if you remember, Tony, but a few years ago there was a ceiling insulation bat, which was like a foam type thing.
Mm-hmm.
They used to call them pink bats,
or
insulation bats.
Mm-hmm.
They're not the flying critters, but the,
insulation
that went into your roof cavity.
Mm.
Some of them are made from wool. Some of them are made from fiberglass. Some of them are made from natural fibers.
Yes.
But in the olden days when dinosaurs roamed the earth, okay, a little bit more recently, they were made with asbestos fibers.
Yeah.
Because asbestos has, it's a natural product, but it retains heat. It absorbs a lot of heat. So in engine bays of cars that got really hot and they wanted to deaden the sound and to stop the hood from overheating, they would put a layer of asbestos over the engine, over the car area.
Yeah.
In houses, similarly, underneath wet areas. So in your laundry, you might have laundry linoleum or laundry tiles that might have a layer of black asbestos underneath. In the roof bats, they used to have fluffy type of material that had asbestos in it.
Yeah.
One of the big companies in Australia that made the news quite often was a company called Mr. Happy.
Yes.
Sorry, Mr. Fluffy.
Yes.
So I think it was either Mr. Happy or Mr. Fluffy. I have to check. I think it was Mr. Fluffy.
Yeah.
But those bats had asbestos in it. So the government has said, we will send somebody in the full clothing,
hazmat
which
gear.
Is asbestos proof, almost a hazmat. It's a full clothing to stop
with a ventilator mask,
a respirator. That's right, a ventilator mask, a respirator, and they will go in, they'll test whatever fluffy stuff you've got on your ceiling, whether it's wool, whether it's fiberglass or something else. They'll send it through to the laboratory and they'll send you back the results to say, is your home the one that perhaps wasn't your, maybe you didn't build it, maybe you bought it 2 years ago, but somebody 30 years ago or 50 years ago put asbestos into it. They'll give you a certificate called a clearance certificate, or at least a certificate to say there's no loose fill asbestos. But think of loose fill as the easiest things to float in the air.
Yes.
It's the fluffy stuff. So if you get a little bit of wind, that loose
it's
fill
just
asbestos can
go everywhere.
Through the, yeah, it can go through your air vents. You know how some walls have little ducts on the side?
Float
it can
through
go
there.
Every time you open the hatchway to get into your ceiling space or to go under your house into your crawl space, they could have hazardous material above or below. So somebody great like Cherie Barber has done so much research. And if you have a look at her website, there's a lot of great asbestos information on there. But it's so important
to know about
the big
it.
A. To know that some walls are made from asbestos. Some glues are made from asbestos. That doesn't mean that you should freak out and do nothing. Because people with a license that have one of three licenses, either an assessor to assess whether you have, or somebody to remove the asbestos, or a different class of license called a Class A, which is to remove the really, really bad asbestos called friable asbestos.
Yes.
That doesn't mean you're allowed to cook it.
No,
but it's a different type of asbestos.
It's the nasty
so you,
type
you can
of
get
asbestos.
And it has to be buried in a different way. It has to be transported a different way.
And it has to be encased and all sorts of things.
somebody who might have 10 renovations under their belt is still not an expert. Somebody who has 100 renovations under their belt is still not an expert. When I spoke to Cherie Barber, we met face to face. She at that time had 116 renovations under her belt. She had completed 116 renovations.
Mm-hmm.
That to me speaks of somebody who's in the trenches, who knows what they're talking about.
Yeah.
You know what Cherie Barber does? She doesn't do her own asbestos inspection.
No.
She pays for a licensed person to come out and to give her a written copy to say what's what, mm-hmm. what not to remove, what should be removed by an expert, and just what looks from the surface to be safe.
Mm-hmm.
So there will always be things hidden inside a wall that's covering another wall, and you mm-hmm. can't tell that.
Yeah.
But there are some things that are reasonably easy to work out because of the type of pattern or the brand name that's written on the product that's there. Mm. I don't want to spend an hour on this, but the eaves.
It's important, though.
Think about your outside of your house, the gutter.
Mm, yes.
Sometimes that surface between the gutter and your wall, that's called an eave.
Yes.
It's that little bit that stops the rain from hitting your windows. So that little protrusion from your house used to be asbestos in almost everything. So almost every house you look at, every unit, used to be asbestos. And now they use a different type of cladding, a different type of sheeting that doesn't have asbestos in it. But when an expert comes out, a licensed expert comes out and gives you the assessment, they might say, okay, well, you've got a certain number of eaves that are made from asbestos. If they're uncracked, undamaged, they'd recommend to do something.
This.
If they're already damaged, if there's a crack, they'd recommend to do something else. Listen to the experts. Tony, I always say the same thing. Everybody that has a profession, is licensed, and has professional indemnity is the right person to speak to.
Correct.
If you're asking somebody that... I was speaking to a friend of mine last week, Tony.
Yeah.
And we were talking about how many children... before you feel that you're an expert in childbirth. So if I had four children, could I walk up to somebody and say, you know what, I don't think you need a cesarean. I think we need to do it this way. But it doesn't work that way. You could have delivered 10,000 children as a doctor and you have 10 children as a parent, but having 10 children doesn't make you the person who should be in the hospital room with your best friend when they're about to give birth because you're hopeless at doing a cesarean.
Yeah.
That's not your speciality.
No.
You've given birth to 10, your pediatrician, your OBGYN has delivered 10,000.
Yes.
10 compared to 10,000. I think of the same thing in renovation.
Yeah.
It's funny to think about, but when it's a life and death thing, when somebody could get seriously ill,
and
or
this
worse,
we're talking
from a renovation,
really ill, like, from asbestos.
Hire an expert.
Yeah.
I mean, hire an expert, really.
Yeah.
It's so important, so important. But coming back to my adventures last week, to move things like wooden doors off the existing cabinets, I know how to use a screwdriver and I know how to stack them up on a wheelie thingy and push them out the curb. That's something I can do.
Yeah.
I wear gloves. I do wear a mask and I usually wear safety goggles. So it's funny to see me on site, but safety is so important. Like, why would you bother doing all this stuff and then get hurt and spend tens of thousands of dollars trying to get healthy again?
Yeah.
Just avoid it.
Yeah.
You know, be responsible.
Yeah.
Anyway, that's enough of a rant on that. Sorry, I went on a bit.
No, I was just going to say.
So that's the big A. That's the asbestos.
I was going to say, Amir, in Australia, that scheme where the government checks rural properties and they have the option of having the asbestos removed or the house, in fact, demolished. So in some instances, those rural properties were so full of asbestos that there really is no other option than to demolish, is there?
I've come across one, so it's very rare that there is that much asbestos. So 3 years ago, I believe it was 3 years ago, around June 2018 maybe, there was a government incentive in New South Wales for them. You book online, so they had a website, you go in and you type in your address details of the year that it was built, and if you fall into a category where they know that, let's say it was Mr. Fluffy, let's say they know that the city you're in was visited by Mr. Fluffy and Mr. Fluffy contracted on 15 houses in that suburb, then you would qualify for them to come and inspect, and if they found loose fill asbestos, they could give you one of two choices. Again, this is about 3 years ago. Yes. They gave you three choices. Either they're going to pay somebody to professionally come and remove the asbestos, vacuum, spray any holes with PVC, which is a glue, to stop any nasty things from flying off, and then give you a receipt, which is called a clearance certificate,
to say that your house
when you sell your house in 3 years' time or 4 years' house, or even if you're not selling your house, but you want to be the renovator, or you want to hire a builder, you can show that clearance certificate to the builder, to the demolition crew, to or yourself to keep it for your records, to say the house is now
safe,
clear, and what was that poltergeist quote, or the Ace Ventura pet detective? This house is clean. I won't do the accent. You can just imagine somebody waving the sage around, going, "I've burned the sage. This
absolutely
house is clean."
And it, and where asbestos is concerned, you're not just you're not just thinking about protecting you and the occupiers of the house. You actually need to protect anyone who comes and works on the house or in the house. You have to protect them from asbestos fibers. So, a big topic. There was a lot of asbestos used throughout Australia, but I'm guessing now in the 2020s that a lot of that would be removed, I would think. That a lot of that would have been encapsulated. I'm sure there's still existing properties that are not, but a lot of them would have been, because there was a lot of media around asbestosis and removing asbestos and why you had to be careful and why you had to dress up in a hazmat suit with a ventilator to make sure that you didn't breathe in the fibers. So for people, there shouldn't be many people not aware of the dangers of asbestos.
There's a lot of people not aware. You'd be surprised how many people are that are not aware of it. So think of the people that are living in the city and now have moved to the country, or people that have lived in a unit where they bought the unit brand new, so it was only built in 2005 or 2015, that never had any asbestos. But then they moved to a more expensive suburb in a 50-year-old block of units.
Right.
Do you remember, Tony, popcorn ceilings?
Yeah, I do.
So a popcorn ceiling was like a little splatter of cement.
Pretty ugly,
and it
really.
It looked like a grey, it looked like a grey, rough surface on your ceiling.
Yes.
And what they did was they mixed together a glue and like a cement or concrete mixture, and then they sprayed it on. They flicked it on. Sometimes they used a machine which looked like a blower to blow it on. But depending on where the cement came from. So remember, asbestos is a natural product. It comes from caves. So when you're mining for concrete, for cement, then depending on which suburb or which city the original fibers came from, they had different minerals that were included in it. So what they found was that a large percentage of the popcorn ceilings came from one of the mines in the United States that had a very high level of asbestos in the walls. So when you find your popcorn ceilings,
you need to get rid of it.
The idea is that they deaden sound.
They did.
So that you don't hear the neighbor above you because it's like a... It just changes the vibrations or the way that the echo goes between level and level.
Yeah.
So the natural thing for somebody who has no experience is to think, do I paint over it? But as I paint, it absorbs a lot of the paint because it's a very rough surface.
Yes.
Do I scrape it off? Because you can scrape it.
Yes, it
does.
So you
can kind of chisel away at it and get to the concrete above. But when you're painting, a little bit of the rubble comes off.
Yeah.
When you're scraping, all the rubble comes off. But if it's got asbestos in it and you're pulling stuff down, every chip releases asbestos. So people don't know, because the product's not called asbestos.
No.
It has a high percentage of asbestos if it came from a specific factory.
Yeah.
And who the hell is going to know 35 years ago which factory sent the materials?
Yeah.
You know, like, you can't tell that.
No.
So the asbestos assessor can go and check. They take a sample, they send it to the laboratory. The laboratory comes back saying it's 0% or it's got some, or it's, you know, hazardous. So people just do things because they think aesthetics. They think of how things look.
Yeah.
Especially in the city. In the country, there's a lot more knowledge about what an asbestos cladding, AC sheet, looks like.
Yes.
AC is asbestos cladding. So the asbestos cladding sheet, or AC sheet, is very well known in the country because they recognize the pattern on the back. It looks like a special pattern.
Yes.
That people recognize and they go, oh, that little hashtag pattern on it means that it's probably going to be AC sheeting. I'm not going to touch that. There's a limit where a builder can come and remove it, triple wrap it in plastic and take it to the asbestos part of the local tip.
Yes.
So there's ways to get rid of small amounts. But the things that most people don't know about are little speckle things on the outside of the houses or the ceilings where they know that if someone did it today, they'd use this chemical, and they assume that whoever did it 35 years ago is using the same chemical that they know of today. Mm. That's not right.
No.
It might be.
Yeah.
But that's one heck of a guess.
Yeah, absolutely.
So, before we run out of time, Tony, I wanted to cover two things. One was time is of the essence. So we've covered that. The second thing is do an asbestos inspection. Because people think about the pest inspection for termites or the property building inspection so that the building doesn't collapse. But they quite often forget about the asbestos inspection.
Yes.
Do it. But then be aware that they're only looking for things that are external. They're not going to break your walls to see which wall is behind the wall that's in the front.
Yeah, so
that makes sense. They're not going to rip up your carpets and test underneath the carpets. They're not going to pull out tiles and check underneath. They'll show you the exposed bits. And if you have permission from the vendor to do a call or to take a sample or to drill a little piece in somewhere, then they can send that as a sample. But quite often, even when you're paying for an asbestos inspector, they can't remove... They can't remove, they can't make holes.
Yeah.
So there are limits to it. The third thing I want to cover. So it's kind of obvious if you're signing a contract that your professional should read the contract before you sign.
Yes.
And we spoke a bit earlier in this episode about if you're in a different territory or a different state, then what's considered a signature might be different in that state. An email might be sufficient.
Yeah.
Or an actual signature and a payment might be sufficient. But there's one other thing that I wanted to cover.
Yes.
And this is very different in different states in Australia and different territories in Australia.
Yeah.
And that's called a nomination clause.
Ah.
So what do I mean by that? This is very interesting. If I decide that my partner and I want to buy a property and I'm at the auction because the auction is 2 hours away, or my partner's working 60 hours a week and they trust me to go and bid at auction, etc. And I sign the paperwork with my name. If in some states I want to add my partner's name to that contract, I have to pay twice. Yep.
Really?
In Queensland, you can change the nomination if the contract allows. In New South Wales, if you change from your name to yours and your partner's name, all of a sudden you're selling 50% of what you bought. In other words, let's say you're going to go half and half with your partner. The state now says, okay, so you bought this in your name, but now you're moving it or selling half of it to your partner. So we're going to charge you the tax on buying it for the first time in your name, and we're going to charge your partner the tax on buying 50% of it the second time.
Oh, my goodness.
You bought something for $1 million and you've paid for $1 million and you've paid for an additional $500,000 of tax.
Wow, Amir, I didn't know about that nomination clause. That's a...
Don't sign. Don't sign first.
Ask
a solicitor. Ask a conveyancer. Before you commit, before you do anything, just ask. And this is not when the emotions are really high in the middle of the auction. This is well beforehand.
Yeah.
Make sure you understand, because it's not the same as everything else.
Mm.
Every state is different.
Yes.
Speak to the expert. Make sure that you go in there with a clear head. And if you have it written down as instructions for you, then when you've won and your hands are shaky from excitement and you tend to forget half the stuff,
you've
got it in writing, just slip over that piece of paper to the auctioneer, to the person who's drafting everything, and they'll have everything agreed both always have it in writing with you, both from your side and from the other side, because these things are done well ahead, well in advance, not when the emotions are high.
Yeah, absolutely. Wow, Amir, I didn't know about that New South Wales clause. That's quite something to be aware of, isn't it? There would be a lot of hardship probably for some people who discovered that at the wrong time in the process of purchasing a property. Could have devastating effects.
The banks tend to have some say in that as well, because if you think about the difference between buying, if I was to buy a property just in my name, or if I was to buy it myself and my partner's name, the bank, if they're issuing a loan to help me finance the purchase, then they might look just at my income, or they might look at my partner's income and my income. So depending on what I want to approach the bank with, that might sway what I write on the contract originally.
And Amir, it would be
And
different and
again, a different set of rules for options.
I was just going to say, and it would be different again if, for instance, your self-managed super fund was purchasing the property, a company was purchasing the property. Again, it comes back to that getting expert advice, doesn't it?
I'd love to say to you, Tony, that a superannuation company can't buy a property.
But they can, can't
So here's the catch.
they? There's
The
always a catch.
self-managed super fund company can have a corporate trustee that looks after the self-managed super fund, but they separate the mortgage to the ownership, and there's something called a bear trust, which is a different type of trust structure that is specifically for one use, for one purpose. And that means that if the property does something or has something done to it, or an accident happens, it burns down, there's a bushfire, there's a flood, there's a hailstorm, there's a limit to how much the self-managed super fund could lose as an asset or be claimed against the super fund because of the contract that's set up. Because the self-managed super fund isn't simply buying it in its name. So when you're doing things in a self-managed super fund, or in a company, or in a family trust, or in a discretionary trust, or in a unit trust, each one of these items has some protection from the government, but also some important things that must be done for it to be recognized as legally purchased by that type of entity. So yes, there's so many different interesting bits there.
Gosh,
But
so
it does
many.
pay to find out what suits you. Because if you're just doing one thing in your life and you're only buying one property, okay, that might
That's
be
straightforward.
straight down the line, might be straightforward. But if you're doing two, or you're doing three, or you're doing 50, there's reasons to do things in different ways. Speak to an expert. I keep going back to that
I
bit. Speak to an
know.
expert. But look,
Absolutely.
let your buyer's agent know. Because when your buyer's agent is making a bid to buy the property, then they need to be quite upfront with how long it'll take you, that the buyer's agent is representing, to finish, to actually sign paperwork, to get things started. So your settlement time between when you pay your deposit and when you're ready to settle might be longer if you're doing a self-managed super fund than if you're
It
doing
would
it in a
be.
family trust or a discretionary trust. Especially if you're controlling the discretionary trust and you're one of two people that are in the discretionary trust or one of the two directors, that might be a lot easier than doing something that requires signatures from 20 people.
Yes, absolutely. Absolutely. Amir, in talking about, just quickly, I had a question about auctions. And if you purchase at auction, your deposit is due then on auction day, isn't it?
Yes, so there is a way around that, but yes, 90% of the time,
I
the
wondered.
condition
That
of
was.
on.
I wondered if they had to always pay that deposit on auction day when they bid in an auction scenario. But you're saying that
Let's
there
say the
are.
auction's on Saturday. If the auction's on a Saturday, on the Tuesday before the Saturday auction, your solicitor would write a letter to the seller's solicitor and say, regarding your upcoming auction on Saturday,
yes,
if my client is the successful buyer, they would like to pay a $1,000 deposit on the day instead of a 10% deposit.
Okay, there you go.
And within 5 business days, they will pay the rest. However, being auction terms means that there is no cooling off period.
Yeah.
Different states and different territories have different rules about how long you can change your mind after committing to buy something.
Yeah.
Let's talk New South Wales for a moment.
Yeah.
In an auction, there is no cooling off period. You're waiving, let's say that a house might have a 5-day cooling off period. That means you might pay a deposit.
Mm-hmm.
And if you change your mind in the first 5 days, you legally write a letter from your solicitor to their solicitor saying, look, I pull out, and you lose a percentage of what you've given as a deposit and you get some of it back.
Okay.
That's all written in the contract as a cooling off period in New South Wales.
Yeah.
But in other states and territories, there's different rules. Some only have a 2-day cooling off period. Some don't allow a cooling off period.
Mm.
Some say in auction conditions, it's already waiving the cooling off period. So if you bid at auction, you don't get to take your deposit back.
No.
Not only do you potentially lose your deposit if you pull out, they can chase you for the rest of the money. If you've now decided to walk away, you don't just lose 10%. They might sell it for $100,000 less than you bid at auction, and they will chase you for the other $100,000. Or there's just a wide range of things that they can do if you win at auction and then run away. They will chase you.
Okay.
So if your solicitor organizes with the other solicitor that for the auction, you just need to pay with a personal check $1,000 on auction day if you're a successful winner.
Yeah.
And within 5 business days, you pay the remaining of the remainder of the 10%.
Yeah.
If the solicitor writes back and agrees, you take that printed piece of paper agreeing from both sides, your solicitor and their solicitor, to the auction on the day.
Yeah.
And when you win, you hand over your $1,000 deposit check and they staple that to the letter from the other side's solicitor saying this was agreed before auction.
Yeah.
Obviously, you can't do that on the Saturday.
No.
You'd want to do that on the Tuesday so that by the Wednesday or Thursday, you have that back in your hands.
Yeah.
And if the other solicitor doesn't agree on the Thursday, you still have the Friday to try option B to say, okay, maybe not 1,000, let's do 15,000 or agree on something that's not on a $4 million property.
Yes.
The deposit's $400,000.
Yes.
So maybe you don't want to pay
carry
the
$400,000
on the Saturday, but wait with, you know, 5 business days to finish the rest.
Yeah.
But if you can't afford something, don't bid on it.
No.
If you're not going to come up with the deposit, you're not going to come up with the rest of the money anyway.
Crazy idea.
Yeah, but 90% of the time you do have to pay the deposit on the day.
Mm-hmm.
And for that, you walk into the bank that is holding the majority of your money.
Mm-hmm.
Let's say it's Commonwealth Bank, National Australia Bank, ANZ or Westpac.
Yes.
When you walk into their branch, they can print you a personal checkbook. A personal checkbook means that you write the number in.
Yes.
It's different to a bank check.
Yes.
A bank check, they actually withdraw the money from your account, and then they put it, they print you the exact amount written on a check.
Yeah.
But you don't know how much you won that property for.
That's right.
It's an auction. So it can go lower or higher or the same as what you're expecting.
Yeah.
With the bank, if you go to a bank branch during the week, so don't leave it to a Friday afternoon.
No.
If you go there during the week, they can print a emergency
checkbook
of 3 checks or 4 checks.
Which is enough.
And that just has your normal name and your bank account that some money is in.
Yes.
It doesn't say how much money is in your account.
No.
But it's a check where you can sign your name on it and
the
bank branch has a copy of your name.
Yep.
And you take that with you to the auction site.
And
so during the auction, when you win, not if you win, but when you win.
When you win,
you write out the check.
Yeah.
So you write the deposit check or whatever you have agreed legally with the other solicitors.
Fantastic.
You can't negotiate with the buyer or with the seller on the day of the auction.
No, and that's the thing about auctions,
isn't it? In New South Wales, anyway.
Mm.
So, it's too late to start negotiating terms on the day.
Absolutely. Amir, we are completely out of time again. What a fascinating conversation around real estate. I'm really appreciative of your time again and walking us through those different elements of pitfalls and warnings, auctions and asbestos. It's been a wonderful conversation. I look forward to our next conversation next week. That's your lot for this week. My wonderful audience, please thank Amir Michel, our real estate expert, on the show today. And we will be back next week with another show and Amir. Bye for now.